This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on June 19th, 2025.
I have a message directly from the president, and I quote, "Based on the fact that there's a substantial chance of negotiations that may or may not take place with Iran in the near future, I will make my decision whether or not to go within the next 2 weeks."
Oh, within the next 2 weeks, eh? Sure you will.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It
ain't. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. And, since Donald Trump says he's going to decide in the next 2 weeks, Desi Doyen, whether or not to bomb Iran and potentially enter the U.S. into another forever war in the Middle East, as he's spent years pretending to MAGA that he would never, ever do, well, it seems that we don't have too much to worry about for now, I guess. Because whenever he says he'll have an announcement in 2 weeks, well, it means he's got absolutely no idea what he's going to do.
True.
Is that about sum it up?
Oh, his health care plan, which is, 2 weeks eternally away.
His health care plan, his great infrastructure plan,
oh,
it's always
yeah.
coming right in about 2 weeks. But it gives us a moment, at least for the next hour, to talk about something else that has fallen, I am afraid, too far below the radar with everything going on over the past month or so, and that is the Trump GOP plan to gut healthcare coverage and much more for millions of low-income and middle-class Americans in order to pay for huge tax cuts to his rich friends. Last month, Republicans in the U.S. House managed to pass their version of a massive budget bill by just one single vote. It is titled, at Donald Trump's insistence, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. One of the reasons for that name is because while congressional legislators had told Trump that it would be much easier to pass his second-term legislative agenda into law if it could be done in several steps, well, President Manbaby was too impatient to tolerate that, and he insisted that all of it be done in, yes, one big, beautiful bill. But the bill, as it turns out, is not so beautiful after all, at least as passed by the U.S. House, especially for middle-class, low-income, and disabled Americans, millions of whom are likely to lose access to health care if the bill is eventually adopted as passed in the U.S. House. That version of the bill, as we reported a month or so ago, would slash more than $1 trillion from health care programs like Medicaid and potentially even Medicare and Obamacare, as well as from the SNAP program, which currently affords about $6 a day to millions of low-income Americans, including millions of children who need nutrition assistance to survive. But sure, let's cut into that $6 a day. Anywhere from 10 to 16 million Americans are likely to lose health care via the House GOP plan, according to various analyses of the bill, which would also add about $3 trillion to the national debt. It would gut pretty much all of President Biden's landmark renewable energy tax incentives for families and businesses alike, despite the manufacturing boom that is kicked off by the Biden and Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act. And all of that to help pay for some $4 trillion in tax cuts, largely to the wealthy and corporations, amounting to the largest cuts to both health care for low-income Americans and to taxes for Americans' wealthiest in American history. That was the House version, which, after passage, was sent to the U.S. Senate, where changes were expected, given the many problems seen with the bill as adopted by the lower chamber. Among those problems, well, the American people seem to hate this bill, and I mean really hate it, as we discussed somewhat on yesterday's program, detailing recent polling, which suggests the measure is wildly unpopular. As Jonathan Cohn summarizes at The Bulwark this week, a new KFF poll, formerly the Kaiser Family Foundation, finds that 64% of respondents, 64% hold an unfavorable view of the bill. Just 35% hold a favorable one. That finding is consistent with two other recent polls, one from Washington Post Ipsos, one from Quinnipiac, that both found the public opposed this bill by a similar, roughly 2-1 margin. The last time major Republican health care legislation drew polling numbers like that, notes Cohn, was near the start of Trump's first term in office when they were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, in its entirety, while making some additional radical cuts to Medicaid. Back in June of 2017, he notes, just a few weeks before that legislation would ultimately fail in the U.S. Senate, KFF's tracking poll found that 55% viewed that bill unfavorably. For the big, beautiful bill, 64% currently oppose it. This bill, at least passed by the House, is even less popular than the failed repeal of Obamacare during Trump's first term. So, no doubt the Senate will fix some of those things that Americans, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike hate about this bill, right? Well, funny story. As Cohn quips at The Bulwark, Senate Republican leaders have been unveiling their version of Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill bit by bit this week. And if you thought they were going to dial back some of the sweeping health care cuts from legislation their House counterparts passed last month, boy, are you in for a surprise. As our friend David Dayan reports this week over the American Prospect, all they did in the Senate was make the bill worse for states, worse for patients, as states react by cutting programs back, and worse for hospitals as they lose more and more insured patients. The health care coverage losses, he says, will likely be worse than in the House, which also means more people will die as a result of the Senate's actions. Joining us now for some clarity, perhaps, on what Senate Republicans have changed in this bill as it moves forward toward Donald Trump's goal of final passage in both houses by July 4, is former Biden-Harris White House advisor to the director of the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, former head of budget analysis for the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, Bobby Cogan, who is now senior director of federal budget policy at the Center for American Progress. Mr. Cogan, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Brad, thank you so much for having me back on.
Delighted to have you. When last we spoke, a little more than a month ago, I think, as the House had adopted its version of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, at the time, you focused on the cruel harm that this would cause to millions of Americans who would lose their access to health care via Medicaid cuts, as well as to nutritional food assistance. And well, I know that the Senate Finance Committee has only just released their updates to the House bill a day or two ago. The reports that I have seen almost uniformly suggest that rather than fix those concerns, the Senate bill actually makes them worse. Is that right as you see it?
Yeah, that's right. The Medicaid cuts in the Senate version are more extreme than in the House version. The SNAP cuts are slightly less extreme. The Medicaid cuts are slightly more extreme. I think all the folks who have been saying, yeah, you know, if the House version was 10.9 million people kicked off their insurance, kind of relative to the CBO baseline, and then 16 million relative to kind of how things are working right now, this one will be more than that, a million more, 2 million more, simply more people kicked off, more states losing more money, and harsher work requirements that are kicking off parents of you know, teenagers.
And as we focused on the Medicaid cuts the last time we spoke, which, you know, according to these independent estimates, will actually kill an estimated 51,000 people a year and cause, as you said, anywhere from 10 to 12 to 16, who knows how many millions to lose their health insurance. It should also be noted that it's estimated another 5 million or so will lose access to health care via the Affordable Care Act exchanges, as I understand it, for pushing this up to some 16 million Americans that could be cut off from health care. I know much of the focus has been on Medicaid, but as David Dayan details over at The Prospect, folks who purchase insurance via the Obamacare exchanges could also lose health care, access to health care, under the big, beautiful Republican plan. Is that right? And B, has the Senate bill fixed any of that as far as you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's completely right. And there are kind of two different sorts of things going on for ACA. Number one, they are in the Biden administration, we made the ACA better. We enhanced the premium tax credits that made them better for poor folks and then also better for kind of working income, working class folks kind of up the income scale. Mm-hmm. That is set to expire in 2025. And if they don't do anything, right, if mm-hmm. they simply do nothing, that will go away and that will kick 4.2 million people off their health insurance. So that's part of it. And then they are also going beyond kind of the pre-Biden status quo. And that's another few million people kicked off of the exchanges, right? So the Medicaid portion is around 8 million. And then the ACA part is another 2 or kind of 3 million plus maybe that other 4 million, depending on whether you want to count that thing that is already set to go away, but that would affect real people. And I really quickly, while you mentioned, you mentioned that this would kill lots of people. That's actually a point that Republicans, when you say that to them, they get indignant. They say, "How dare you?" But it's really basic logic, right? If you cut $1 trillion of funding uh-huh. that is all about providing health coverage to people, then you better believe that with $1 trillion less, there will be fewer people covered.
Right.
And then if you have fewer people covered, some of those people are going to get really sick. And of those people who get really sick, some of them will heal on their own and some of them won't. And of the people who therefore need to go seek treatment, despite the fact that they're covered, some of them will be able to afford it and some of them won't be able to afford it. And of the people who can't afford it, some of them will eventually get better and some of them won't get better where they would have otherwise gotten better if they'd had coverage. This is basic logic, but basically Republicans are too afraid to admit that they don't think the money is worth it.
Well, they should be. I mean, that's a very serious point. And on top of that, it's not just, as I understand it, it's not just people who are actually literally, losing access to health care via these cuts. But then there are hospital closures as well that could affect everyone and people's ability, even if they are covered, to even get coverage. Anthony Wright, the executive director of Families USA, told the Bulwark, quote, "In your average maternity ward or your average nursing home or your average rural hospital, Medicaid is usually the primary payer, the biggest line in the budget. If that gets scaled back, that impacts everybody who goes there, regardless of whether they are on Medicaid or not." He says, quote, "Dozens and dozens of rural hospitals would be in trouble if these cuts become law." He adds, quote, "Having people covered means more people are paying patients at the providers that we all depend on. Having fewer people covered means less revenue, which means scaled back services or closures for those services already on the brink." Does that sync up with your own analysis? Because it sounds like hospitals will actually be shut down just from the part of the costs of $1 trillion cut to Medicaid.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These folks are no longer getting services and therefore the hospitals are no longer getting the money. And then some of them are showing up in the emergency room and being covered without any or getting care without any coverage, and the hospitals have to eat that as well. So it's kind of a double hit for the hospitals. And there is some acknowledgement of this. Susan Collins, who voted against the ACA kind of repeal trial mm-hmm. run in 2015 mm-hmm. and voted against the real deal in 2017, floated the other day saying, oh, well, there should be a fund to go help the hospitals, which, you know, that'll help some, but it won't do the whole thing. And also it'll still leave the people without the, you know, the dead people without their coverage. But yeah, it's a real concern. I think there's some acknowledgement of it. Some people have their heads in the sand and other people say, oh my gosh, that's actually a major problem. And exactly as you say, it affects not only the people who have lost their coverage,
right.
but then if your hospital closes, then everyone else is in trouble, even if you have coverage through your work or through your spouse or through Medicare or through anything else.
And it seems like that the hospitals that are most likely to be shut down in this case, the ones with the smallest funding already, happen to be in rural areas, which means areas that are most supportive of Donald Trump, no? And Republicans.
Yeah, that's right. You are not the first person, and I think it cannot be said enough, right, that this is something that obviously this is bad on the merits, but it's also pretty wild that this bill would disproportionately hit a lot of people who voted for Trump, right? Like mm-hmm. a lot of Trump's supporters are on Medicaid and would, you know, and they don't, some of them know that they're on Medicaid and some of them don't know they're on Medicaid because the states, they're all run by the states and there might be a version of it
right.
that is not technically called Medicaid. And they say, I'm not on Medicaid, I'm on insert state's version of Medicaid.
Medi-Cal is what we call it
exactly.
out here. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. And all those folks are going to be hurt. And you see, the new West Virginia senator saying, hey, I'm really worried about this. And they were worried before and they're more worried now. I mean, one of the things that they're doing is they weren't just freezing additional kind of provider tax payments, but they would ratchet down states that have already instituted provider tax payments above a certain level. And that would deprive states of funding that they use to run Medicaid. A lot of the people who are against the provider taxes, they call it a gimmick, right? It's the way that states are getting money that maybe wasn't kind of directly intended, mm-hmm. but it is a totally legal maneuver that 49 states do. And then they don't use the money fraudulently. They use the money to cover people on Medicaid,
right.
To help provide better benefits and cover more people. So if you get rid of it, it just means that there's less money for Medicaid and a lot of people therefore are kicked off. And so you have a lot of folks, who are really, really, really worried and nonetheless might be voting for it. And that's kind of what's so wild about this. You have a lot of Republicans throwing up warning signs and then they're still moving forward. They're birdbathing. They've been birdbathing all week. They're birdbathing today. They're birdbathing tomorrow. They're birdbathing over the weekend. And they are moving as if they are trying to have this done next week.
So what exactly is birdbathing?
And that's where they're fighting with the parliamentarian about whether all the provisions adhere to the Senate rules or not. Mm-hmm. And so that's happening right now.
Got it. Do Republicans understand this stuff, but they're just doing it anyway? Do they think that, you know, the bill it won't hurt them politically? They understand, but they think they can get away with it? Or are they just in some kind of state of denial about the very real ramifications and political costs of all of this, not just to Medicaid, people on Medicaid, which I think, you know, which is bad enough, but really to everyone? Is there sort of a state of denial about this, or do they think, oh, it's not going to kick in for a while, so we'll make it through next year's midterms? What are they thinking? Do you have an understanding of that?
Yeah, I think it's different member by member. Some are just afraid to cross Trump. And, you know, they have publicly and privately said that they are not okay with it, but then it doesn't matter because they care more about their jobs. You know, they're more worried about what Trump would do to their ability to get reelected than what their voters would do. You know, the Medicaid work requirements don't start until after the election, and then they could try to blame it on the Democrats
somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Post-election, blame it on the Democrats. That there's some of that. There are, I would just say, when you listen to members talk and when you listen to them make excuses and deal with criticisms, it's very clear that most members don't know a single person on Medicaid. just, you know, when they talk about the difficulty and pretend that there's no difficulty, when they say, oh, well, it's just the fraud we're going, you know, it's very clear that they don't know a single person on Medicaid. I know a lot of people on Medicaid. I have a lot of my friends are on Medicaid. I have family on Medicaid, and I have talked them through, like, oh, if I take this job, that's $2 more an hour, then I'm going to lose my Medicaid. And yes, I'll get the exchange, but then my doctor might not take, you know, and going through and all the thought processes. And, oh, well, I did this and now it's a different income. I earned less for this month. And so now, or earned more in this month. And so now I'm in trouble and blah, 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 right? Like going through all the difficulties, this stuff is really difficult. And it's very clear that these folks don't know anyone and don't care, right? Like this is something that would, and I just say really fast, right? The work requirements, the states that have done it have been a disaster. And I forget the name of the guy, but when Georgia was instituting its work requirement, they found a guy on Medicaid who was their poster child. And he was on a bajillion ads for the governor saying, this is great. Like, I work hard. Other people mooch. I think this is a great idea. And he lost his Medicaid twice since it's been instituted, despite the fact that he was working the whole time, because the red tape was such a disaster.
Yeah.
So you ask him now and he is no longer supportive, right? It's just because they don't know anyone. They don't care. They think all the concerns are BS, and they don't know anyone that is going to be affected. And so I think that's a major part of it.
Well, there are going to be a lot of people affected, and not just from Medicaid. David Dayan over at Prospect says the Congressional Budget Office's assessment of the House version of the bill shows that the lowest 10% of income earners will lose about 4% of their income, which he notes is a recession level of contraction, while the top 10% will gain around 2.3%. If you add in the effects of Trump's across-the-board tariffs, the bottom 80% of the income distribution will lose money from Trump policies, and only the top 20% would gain. That's a lot of loss for a lot of Americans who are, as you note, already struggling. And that sort of goes beyond, above and beyond the issue of health care with what these guys are trying to do by July 4 before anyone notices.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why, I mean, what they're doing is really, really, really unusual. There isn't really a correlate in history that looks like this. You could, where it is high cuts for low-income people, large cuts for low-income people, mm-hmm. at the same time they're doing tax cuts, really, for the rich. Mm-hmm. In the Reagan era, he was smart enough to do his cuts for low-income people in a different bill than his tax cuts for the rich. And in the Clinton cuts were either cuts paired with tax increases on the rich, mm-hmm. or basically cuts by themselves. And then the closest thing you could say is in 1997, there were some spending cuts and there was a little bit of tax cuts for the rich with their cap gains cut. But the spending cuts they were doing at the time were basically not the spending cuts for the poor. It was kind of these broad amorphous spending cuts. Mm-hmm. And so what's so unique about this bill, I mean, the only thing that I can think of is Contract with America, which failed and was vetoed, where you have enormous cuts for the poor at the same time you're doing tax cuts for the rich. So that exactly right. The CBO analysis shows it would make the poorest Americans poorer while making the richest Americans richer in the same bill. And when you incorporate the tariffs, it's only the richest who are winning, right? Yeah. It's just a crazy bill. It's a crazy thing to go to your constituents and say, you elected me to take from the poor to give to the rich while increasing the deficits by trillions of dollars. Like, that's a crazy thing.
And that was, you know, the big outcry coming out of the House for this bill from the so-called fiscal hawks and the so-called Freedom Caucus is, in both the House and the Senate, was that, well, they didn't like this bill because it added some $3 trillion to the national debt over 10 years. But rather than, you know, lower in any way the tax cuts to close that gap, Instead, they said, well, you know, we don't like deficits, so we're going to increase the cuts to health care. And I know that folks like Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson, he had previously insisted, oh, he was a hard no on this bill. But now it seems, now that it's in the Senate, he sort of seems to be suddenly okay with it. Why? Has the deficit spending been lowered there, or are so-called fiscal hawks like Johnson only actual fiscal hawks when a Democrat is in the White House?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. there's an amazing line where Mitch McConnell gave to Trump in his first term, where he was encouraging Trump to spend more on discretionary. And he said, no one ever lost an election spending more money. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans really, you know, they typically tend to do their biggest cuts under Democratic presidencies, where they kind of, you know, hold the country hostage and force it over a when the debt limit is up and say, we'll force a default unless we get it. These ones are interesting. I mean, as you correctly say, they care more about tax cuts than they care about deficits. But they do really like the spending cuts. So they would, if the choice is between having a higher deficit or lower tax or less of a tax cut, they'll pick the higher deficit. Mm. But they do really want the spending cuts to go along with it. The Freedom Caucus people successfully negotiated larger spending cuts to low-income people when they were getting through. And that's been Ron Johnson's push as well.
I mean, they could even get all of these terrible cuts to healthcare. They could get them in a bill that doesn't expand the deficit if they just remove those tax cuts. They'd come in about even, and they could say, well, look, we've taken away waste, fraud, and abuse from healthcare, which, by the way, is not what they're doing at all, but they could
Correct.
Say that, and they could say, and we did it all without increasing the deficit. They ain't doing that.
Yeah, that's right. It's right. And I actually think that that's actually a major part of why it is so profoundly unpopular. If they had come in and said the deficit is out of control, we need to go after waste, fraud and abuse, and they had done just the spending cut portion, as you say, it wouldn't have been correct. But I think that that could have been a message that they could have tried to deliver. You cannot credibly say, oh, we just have to go after this spending, this waste, fraud and abuse, while we increase the deficit by trillions of dollars, right? Then it's clear what you're doing. You're cutting because you hate the program and you want to take away the benefits mm-hmm. from people who rely on them.
Yeah.
And that's why putting them in the same bill is so uncommon. And in fact, this was in the mid-2000s, Republicans tried to do this where they did a tax cut. And then later, like months later, they came for a similar size Medicare cut. And even separating it by months, you know, Democrats said, oh, so you cut the taxes here to, you know, and then you're paying for it with the Medicare cuts, like, you know, a couple months later. That did not go very well for them. Mm. And so, you know, you mentioned that this was unpopular. And I would just say it's not just that it's unpopular. Poll after poll has shown that the more that people learn about the bill,
yeah.
the more they hate it. It's unpopular just based on what people do know. And the more accurate information they get about the bill, the more they're like, oh, that's a really bad bill.
Well, we aim to serve. Let me hit a couple of points along those lines. We're running short on time, but I want to get in a couple of other points. Aside from the healthcare, you also, you yourself, Bobby Kogan, played a key role in the White House on Joe Biden's landmark Inflation Reduction Act, the largest ever single investment in clean, renewable energy initiatives anywhere in the world, I believe. What does this bill, the big, beautiful bill as currently written, due to gut those initiatives? And isn't that also a very bad idea, even for Republicans in both the House and Senate?
Yeah, I'll start with the second part of it first and then switch into the first. Honestly, legitimately, I think a lot of folks were taken aback. There is a lot of wariness from from everyone who benefits from these investments. From having them taken away. And I think folks thought that that would protect them. And instead, Republicans are forging full on ahead. It'll leave a lot of businesses in America worse off, and it'll increase our carbon output. So,
and a lot of them in Republican districts, Republican states.
That's right. I mean, when we were putting it together, we tried really hard to make sure that the investments were broad and in rural areas. Part of it was trying to revitalize a lot of you know, a lot of American areas that basically had been pretty stagnant or declining. And mm-hmm. so that, you know, we deliberately tried to set up grants and, you know, and whatnot mm-hmm. in areas that are Republican. So, yeah, so their IRA was a massive bill that created direct spend over here and various tax investments and everything. But the meat of them was that we were trying to greenify the grid. That was going to be, you know, there were lots and lots of kind of pushes and pulls all throughout it. But mm-hmm. the most important part was we were going to try to basically, you know, there was going to be a heavy incentive for all corporations to have and use green energy. Mm-hmm. And if their demand for green energy was enough, then they were going to make sure that their supply of green energy was going to be enough. Mm-hmm. And then that was going to greenify the grid. And I think, you know, lots of folks correctly say, oh, well, you know, is it my individual consumption or is the business that I'm buying from? Well, it's sort of the same thing. I'm buying from them and that's, you know, and that's where the carbon output comes. Mm-hmm. And so if the places that I'm buying from are all green, then we're in great shape. Mm-hmm. And so that was really the meat of it. And that's something that they are really rapidly trying to undo. It would end up increasing carbon output significantly. And also at the same time, it would make a lot of corporations worse off. You know, and this was kind of, you know, folks at the time thought that we were being really clever. We were going to say, this is going to help protect it because the business community will say, don't you dare get rid of this. And they have said, don't you dare get rid of this. And also they're moving forward with it anyway.
So businesses are against what they're doing when it comes to the cuts to the IRA.
So they're at the same time they're doing the bonus depreciation, but this is why the distributional analysis is kind of so funky across the years. It's because a lot of the corporate giveaways they did in Trump Tax Cuts 1.0, and they're doing some corporate giveaways this one, and at the same time they're going after these investments that help greenify the grid and, you know, and help, you know, kind of make sure that businesses are polluting less, and, you know, give them money to make sure that they are polluting less. And if you take that away, then they are hurting more. So, you know, the net effect of kind of getting rid of all of these is our utility, you know, average household utility prices go up.
Yep.
Our energy is more expensive and dirtier at the same time, right? Kind of the worst of both worlds.
We're awesome, aren't we? There's one thing that Republicans are trying to sort of highlight and say, hey, this you really, America, you'll like this, is there the no tax on tips provision that Trump had called for on the campaign trail. First, is that still in the bill to your knowledge? And second, as you may know, we've asked you know, readers of the Brad blog and listeners of the Bradcast and of our Green News reports to hit our tip jar over the years at bradblog.com. So, Bobby Kogan, does that mean I will no longer have to pay taxes on those donations I receive via the tip jar from folks under the big, beautiful bill?
That's fun. Yes, it's still in the bill. It's a temporary provision in the bill. But you would expect it to be continued. No tax on tips is still in there. It's I don't know if the current version, because as you maybe were kind of facetiously alluding to, one of the problems with no tax on tips is that people could reorganize their work to get paid,
right,
take their normal pay and reorganize it as
tips
income. And then all of a sudden they're just getting lower. You know, they've gotten a meaningless tax.
Well, can't accountants do that? Website developers? Oh, the service is free, but I'd really appreciate a tip if you like what the work I've done. I mean, can they get away with that?
Well, so the smarter versions of this try to limit it to industries that have, quote unquote, been traditionally tip heavy, and to basically make it so that you can't just then make that a reality in every area. It's still a problem inside of those areas. And then the smarter ones try to make it so that there's an income limit or whatever. I haven't actually dug through how the Senate version works. But, you know, even if you did the smartest version, the problem with no tax and tips has another problem, which is, you know, if I'm a server making 40 grand a year, mm-hmm. why should I pay taxes that are different than a teacher making 40 grand
right.
a year
right.
or an EMT making 40 grand a year? Right. Like why? Like that is, I mean, it's a concept known as horizontal inequity. But basically the idea is if you make this much, you should be treated like anyone else. And that is like one of the fundamental problems with no tax on tips. It obviously it pulls really well for a lot of folks, but it doesn't really make any sense. And if we want to be helping folks in, you know, in the bottom end, which we obviously should be doing, there are much smarter ways to do it that don't at the same time allow for cheating kind of all throughout.
Or a cook or a host or in that very same restaurant.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Lastly, we got to get out of here, but we played a clip from yesterday's show from Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, arguing that if Democrats stick together, given the unpopularity of this bill, he believes they can actually kill it. Now, that seems to me to be a very tall order, in my opinion, especially since Trump has pretty much, you know, wrapped up his entire legislative agenda into this one bill. You played a key role in the Biden White House on major bills there, seeing them passed with arguably even, you know, smaller margins for your party. So is Senator Schatz crazy, or is there an actual possibility that this bill could be killed or at least radically changed to remove some of the most objectionable parts of it? Though, you know, which one are the most objectionable is maybe the real question. But can this be killed, or is this a foregone conclusion?
Well, I am really worried. We might be able to win, and we owe it to everyone to try with all of our might. In 2017, so this is all going through reconciliation, which mm-hmm. goes through the Senate Budget Committee. In 2017, when they were doing this, I was working at the Senate Budget Committee, and we all thought we were going to lose on ACA repeal. And we had been fighting for months and months and months. And I don't think we won because of us. I think we won because, you know, the hero organizers showed up at every single town hall because they called, you know, hundreds of, you know, because everyone got everyone to call. I think that's why we won. But we didn't think we were going to win. And I remember John McCain flew in and we were like, why would he fly in to vote no? That doesn't make any sense, because if he stayed away, then they don't have the votes. It turned out that he wanted to make a show of himself, so he did fly in so that he could do a giant no vote. Yeah. But at the time, we didn't. That wasn't what we were assuming. So they have worse margins in the House and better margins in the Senate than that one. This is a worse bill than that one. But the Republican Party is more under Trump's grip than last time. And so I am really worried. I think they can pass it. I just think we owe it to fight with all of our might. Everyone listening knows someone. It might be you. It might be your family member. It might be a close friend. It might be a neighbor. But every single person listening to this right now knows someone who will be absolutely hurt by this bill. And like, we owe it to them. We owe it to the people we know and we love and we care about. And we owe it to the people who we will never meet, nonetheless, to try to help them, because their lives matter as much as ours. And so I really, really, really hope that we can defeat this. I remember, I will never forget my entire life where I was in the war room, I was in the Senate, I was in the war room when John McCain voted no. Mm-hmm. And I remember everyone just kind of got quiet and the body language changed. And then Pence left the room, and then his motorcade lights turned on and he left. And we were all like, wow. You know, we all thought, I'll never forget that. And it was just because it's like, honestly, I'm like more proud of like all that work than anything else I've ever done in my life. And we owe it to the people to try to help. And so I hope Schatz is right. I'm really, really, really worried, but we owe it, you know, we owe it to try.
Last time you were on, I think you said the ticket here for the American people is contact your senators, let them know, and which people can do. They can call 202-224-3121 to let your senators know, whether you're in a red state or a blue state, how you feel about this so-called big, beautiful bill and the harm that it is going to do to millions of your fellow Americans and maybe even you. Bobby Kogan, thank you for joining us again. I've been worried with so much going on, so much else going on, you know, Trump's invasion of L.A., the arrest of Democratic officials, the Israel-Iran war and everything else, that this bill is moving ahead in the Senate, sort of below the radar of the national media. making it even harder to stop or at least improve somehow. So thank you for helping us get the word out. Do not be surprised if we touch base again before or even after all of this is said and done, sir.
Happy to come on anytime, Brad. Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Bobby Kogan is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress, formerly at the White House Budget Office and the Senate Budget Committee. You can find him on The Blue Skies at BB Kogan, and you can find his work at AmericanProgress.org. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, by the way, we don't have to wait for the big, brutal bill to go into effect, if it does, for Trump's policies to gut American healthcare. They already are doing so with the new visa restrictions and travel ban that was recently put in place from 19 countries, threatened to expand to more than 30 more. I will explain that after a quick break. And the first hurricane of the season made landfall on Thursday morning. That story and much more in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report.
Yes.
All of that straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Born in Northeast Haiti with a heart defect, Brad Mertens Joseph is 6 years old. He has difficulty walking. He is still in diapers. His parents, accustomed to a dangerous 9-hour overnight bus ride to see cardiologists in the country's violent capital in Haiti, had finally found a solution to their son's medical ailment caused by a hole in his heart. It involved open surgery in Akron, Ohio, arranged by a nonprofit. Those plans collapsed, however, at the beginning of the month when President Trump issued an order banning people from a dozen countries, including Haiti, who don't already have valid travel visas from entering the U.S. The boy's father said, quote, "When I heard that, I was really upset and I wondered, what are we going to do? I was panicking," he said, "and I am still panicking." The Josephs are among the many Haitians who were caught in the middle of Trump's sweeping travel ban, from young professionals to medical residents, who I'll get to in a second, to longtime visitors whose visas have lapsed. Haitians are bracing for the consequences of having a lifeline abruptly cut. More than 300 Haitians, mostly children, are currently on waiting lists for surgery and now are unable to get treatment because they are barred from traveling to the United States, according to Owen Robinson, the executive director of the International Cardiac Alliance, a nonprofit based in the U.S. that arranged for Brad's treatment in Ohio. Finding enough doctors and hospitals in other countries to make up for the sudden loss will be extraordinarily difficult, Mr. Robinson said. If we could, we would. But hey, maybe you're MAGA. Maybe you don't care about children from other countries not being able to get life-saving health care. America first, right? Well, yeah, funny thing there, too. If you're worried about what the health care in this country might look like if Republicans pass Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, it will take health care away from some 15 million Americans to pay for tax cuts to the rich while killing tens of thousands of low-income Americans of all political stripes in the bargain, well, you may not have to wait for that bill to be passed and signed by Trump into law to see how he is already undermining the health care system for everybody in America. Yes, Americans. As the New York Times reported last night, travel and visa restrictions imposed by the Trump administration threaten patient care at hundreds of hospitals in America that right now depend on medical residents recruited from overseas. Foreign medical residents often serve as the frontline caregivers at busy safety net hospitals in low-income communities. Normally, the residents begin work on July 1 each year. Orientation programs for some of them have already started. Now, some of those hospitals are racing to prevent staffing shortages. Quote, if international medical graduates cannot start their medical residencies on time on July 1, the ramifications are so far-reaching that it is really unconscionable, said Kimberly Pierce-Burke, executive director of the Alliance of Independent Academic Medical Centers. Senior residents leave hospitals in June and go on to start their careers, she noted. Hospitals rely on new residents to replenish their ranks beginning in July. Quote, if they don't come on July 1, that leaves a hole in the patient care team, she said. Who's going to pick up the slack? And yet, on May 27, the Trump administration suspended new interview appointments for foreign nationals applying for J-1 visas, the visas for participants in cultural or educational exchange programs like residencies are used by most medical residents arriving from overseas. On Wednesday this week, the State Department lifted the pause on visa appointments, according to an official, but it was not immediately clear how many or how quickly physicians could be granted their visas. The process now also includes, quote, enhanced social media vetting, supposedly intended to ferret out potential security risks, according to the official The Times spoke with, though more recent reporting suggests that enhanced social media vetting requiring people applying for visas mandates that social media accounts must be set to be public so that they can be reviewed by officials to make sure that, you know, they didn't say anything that the Trump administration doesn't like. Aside from those anti-American obstacles to freedom of speech placed on visa applicants by the Trump administration, how quickly are they going to be able to review all of these social media accounts to determine if applicants' politics are satisfactory to the Trump administration? Moreover, the administration has also banned or restricted travel entirely to the U.S. from 19 countries and may extend that restriction to an additional 36 countries. The Times reports that foreign doctors from countries covered by the bans and other restrictions could request a so-called national interest exception, but it's not immediately clear how that process would actually work, and the American medical system, meanwhile, relies heavily on physicians from other countries in our hospitals. One in five U.S. physicians was actually born and educated overseas, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. New doctors from other countries account for one in six medical residents. In 2024, the Educational Commission on Foreign Medical Graduates sponsored more than 15,500 doctors from over 150 countries to fill residencies or fellowship training spots at 770 hospitals. Those are the numbers that hospitals are now racing to fill with the J-1 visa pause now lifted just over a week before new residents are needed to be in place at almost 800 hospitals, with total bans, meanwhile, in place from 19 countries and perhaps 36 more very shortly. Residents are the foot soldiers of hospitals, critical to their operation. They often work up to 80 days. Many foreign medical residents stay and build their careers in the U.S. after their residencies. They go into primary care fields like internal medicine, family medicine, pediatrics, areas where there is a shortage of American medical graduates. Many non-citizen doctors accepted for residencies reportedly secured visas prior to May 27, but an estimated 1,000 were not able to. And the vacancies will have a disparate effect on various hospitals. Dr. Christos Barris, who oversees the residency program at Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, said, we just don't know what the impact will be. We have residents from literally all over the world, every continent. Their internal medicine residency program relies on foreign medical graduates to staff about 90% of its 55 positions. So you know, this could be bad. So far, just two non-citizens have been blocked from entering the country, according to the director of the program at Brookdale. He says, if I'm missing two or three people, I can fill those spots. But next year, we're not talking about two or three. He said, we're talking about missing thousands. If the travel restrictions are maintained, it would gut the program, he said. And by the way, it will gut your health care along with it. Quote, this is the new generation of physicians for Americans, said Dr. Douglas DeLong, who has worked in academic training programs. These are the physicians who will take care of us as we age. They are the future of medicine. That future is now in peril. On another point of peril and of our survival and the future of humanity, frankly, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
A dangerous situation unfolding for the southwestern coast of Mexico with rapidly intensifying Hurricane Eric.
Pacific hurricane season off to an unusually early and ferocious start. Trump administration's mass layoffs and budget cuts seriously impacting national parks. Plus, congressional Republicans' big budget bill would increase energy prices, sell off public lands.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BrandBlog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I've deployed thousands of National Guard troops and hundreds of Marines to protect federal law enforcement. If we didn't do it, there wouldn't be a Los Angeles. It'd be burning today, just like the houses were burning a number of months ago.
I know I'm not saying anything new right now, but he is such a
This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, yeah, he is. That said, not a great time for it to be an early and ferocious start to hurricane season.
Yep, the Pacific Ocean is already on its fifth named storm in just 3 weeks. Off the west coast of Mexico, Hurricane Eric rapidly intensified into a major Category 3 storm in a matter of hours on Wednesday, fueled by unusually warm ocean waters before making landfall early Thursday morning near the resort town of Acapulco, which was devastated in 2023 by Hurricane Otis, a Category 5 storm that also rapidly intensified.
And we saw a lot of rapid intensification last hurricane season, where hurricanes sort of used to calm down as they got close to shore. They seem to be growing in intensity as they get close to landfall these days.
Yes, they are. Studies show that rapid intensification of storms is now much more common due to ocean heating driven by man-made global warming.
So it's not just my imagination.
In other news, the Wall Street Journal reports that America's electric bills are now rising even faster than the cost of groceries, mostly due to increased natural gas exports, reducing domestic supply, and rising demand from data centers.
So Trump's big thing was to sell off more gas, which means we have less of it, which means we pay more for electricity.
Exactly. Oil prices are also spiking as Israel's conflict with Iran threatens oil production and shipping. In Congress, the Republican majority's big, brutal budget bill abruptly halts Biden-era federal tax breaks and incentives that several studies project will increase the average family's energy bill by as much as $400 per year within a decade. Also, the Senate Republicans have inserted a provision into the bill requiring the mandatory sell-off of 3 million acres of your public lands, the largest single sale of national public lands in modern history, fast, with no public or tribal input, all to fund massive tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations. Republicans' proposed budget bill also kills off federal clean energy incentives in the landmark Inflation Reduction Act that have disproportionately benefited Republican-leaning states. The Trump administration's rollbacks of Biden-era clean energy policies and tax credits are already hurting red states, with manufacturers halting construction of new plants and projects and the jobs that came with them, like a new billion-dollar EV battery manufacturing facility in South Carolina that was paused late last week.
Rather have China build those batteries instead, I guess.
A new study finds that the Trump administration's clean energy rollbacks will hurt the U.S. economy long term. The University of Maryland analysis projects that the potential costs to public health, households, and the economy include a shocking $1 trillion hit to U.S. gross domestic product by 2035.
Brilliant.
The researchers found that any short-term economic boost from Trump's rollbacks would be overwhelmed by the long-term negative impacts of gutting new domestic manufacturing and jobs, plus higher public health costs from the impacts of increased pollution.
He is such a...
And finally, the Trump administration's massive funding cuts and mass layoffs are seriously eroding our national parks, creating a severe worker shortage across the country as tourism season kicks into high gear. At Yosemite, nearly all staffers, even scientists, are taking turns cleaning campground toilets. The superintendent of Crater Lake National Park in Oregon, Kevin Heatley, resigned earlier this month, saying in an interview with KGW Portland that Trump's deep cuts are damaging the nation's national treasures and are unsustainable.
I did not want to be empowering the current administration to cause that kind of impact on the people that I'm responsible for. And I also did not want to participate in the effectively a dismantlement of the National Park Service.
Good for him. It's going to be a long, hot summer. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's a cruel, cruel.
Cruel summer and an exceptionally cruel broadcast, I think, today. Sorry about that, folks. Thanks for hanging in there with us. And thanks to Desiree Doyen, our producer, and to my guest today, former White House budget advisor Bobby Kogan of the Center for American Progress, and to all of you for sharing a portion of your cruel day with us. It is greatly appreciated. Always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That free service is made possible by those of you who hit a donate button when you stop by Bradblog or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves, cruel or otherwise. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. You will find Desiree
at Green News Report.
There you go. We'll see you there. Until we see you next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
It's a cruel...
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.